Okay, this is November 25th, and this is part three of an interview between me, Melissa Wilcox, and my mom, Margaret Wilcox, and we are here in Shingle Springs, California. I haven't said this in the previous parts, but we're sitting on the back patio overlooking beautiful rolling hills that have just turned green because there was a rain a couple of weeks ago, and some plum trees and lilacs that are dropping their leaves, some oaks that are starting to drop their leaves, and there's just, it's gotten more and more cloudy over the course of the afternoon, and there's just a light breeze that comes up every once in a while and gets the wind chimes going in the background. So we had said that we were going to start this section of the interview talking about everything that was going on around you. In some ways, you and Dad were both at ground zero of the social movements of the 1960s and the 1970s, being in Berkeley. And you were, in some ways, in very different social locations relative to those movements, with Dad being faculty and you being an undergrad, but simultaneously a faculty wife. I'm not going to say spouse, because it was very much wife at that time was the role. Almost as unthinkable as first gentleman in the White House is today, which hopefully won't be unthinkable by the time some people are listening to this interview. So I'd wanted to ask you what it was like to have that kind of stuff going on around you as an undergrad and as a grad student, also as a faculty wife, and the things that you learned and gained from those movements, and the ways in which you found those movements to not be things that drew you in some ways.
Yeah, it was an amazing time to be at Berkeley. When I started my coursework at Berkeley, which would have been in 1964, fall of 1964, it was still pretty much a traditional college campus, the way I remember it. But it very quickly became the what felt to me like the center of political activism. And so my perspective was that of a student who had a lot of classes in Dwinnell Hall and Wheeler Hall. So I was right in the center of the Sproul Hall Plaza area of the Berkeley campus. Yeah. When I first started there, I was really interested in volunteering, and so I got involved with a YWCA program that provided, they called them tutors, but that's too formal a word, to children in West Berkeley. And I remember that being rather a quiet time, where I was just doing coursework and doing my volunteer work, which I really, really totally enjoyed, with a family in the West Berkeley area. And it's fuzzy to me exactly how the movement began to develop. I'd have to go back and reread the growth of the free speech movement and how those issues very quickly took over the campus. And I was torn. I mean, on the one hand, I definitely identified as a student at Berkeley, and I definitely was interested in the student's perspective. I was dismayed at the number of people who were involved that were not UC Berkeley students, that were coming to Berkeley to be part of a movement that they believed was a very important movement politically. I was not of that group. I was very much of the group of students who were, many of whom, not me, many of whom were very engaged in what was going on with the free speech movement. And because so many of my classes were right there at Sproul, I had the opportunity to occasionally pause and listen to the speakers and try and understand what the issues were. I was aware when things got out of hand, and Telegraph Avenue was the central point of a lot of the protests, and there was a lot of violence happening then. On the other hand, I really understood, if you just separate out the debate, what the debate was all about around free speech, I agreed with the free speech movement. I just didn't agree with the way that it was playing out on campus and in the city of Berkeley, with the demonstrations, with the violence, with the destruction. And it's, so I was torn, and I was very aware that the faculty that we were probably most closely connected to tended to be more conservative faculty, who tended to be reactive to the fact that their classes were being disrupted and they didn't like that. They also tended to be on the part of campus that was not near Sproul Hall, so they were on the northwest side of campus. And so many of them just recall the helicopters over campus. They recall the tear gas being dispersed and affecting them and their students. They recall their classes being canceled. I guess I was aware when those kinds of things were happening and just avoided that part of campus during those times. But it had a big effect because I think that for me, it made me much more politically aware than I ever had been. I mean, I grew up in Danville, which is not a highly politicized little town. And yeah, I was in Madison. We were in Madison during what seemed like quiet times to us. But this was a time to become aware of what a political movement could become in terms of potentially making a difference, and also how it could turn into something that was more than just a political movement with a very big but specific agenda.
Sounds like you became aware of the free speech movement was more directly in your awareness than the other movements that were also going on around that time. Mm-hmm. Okay, you're shaking your head or you're...
No, it's the one that was most... it was most powerful in a sense. By powerful, I don't mean that could have the biggest impact. I mean, it was powerful because it was in my face every day, all day long, the sounds, the sights, you know, at the point where it was at its peak. And so it had a huge impact in that way. Did it have a huge impact on me personally? It definitely had an impact. It made me more politically aware. It made me aware of the fact that demonstrating when you feel something is really, really wrong is an effective way to go about it, but it's dangerous because it can get out of hand. The other political movement that I think of during that time was the women's rights movement. And yeah, I read everything I could get my hands on. I really, you know, was actively trying to figure out where am I in this. You know, I, as I said earlier, I knew that I wasn't someone who was going to, as maybe a few of the spokeswomen for us did, declare men to be horrible creatures. They didn't use those terms. Those are my terms. Because I certainly didn't believe that. I've had wonderful men in my life. I've been really lucky, probably, but I have. But I also was very conscious of the fact that being a woman limited me. And, you know, as I said to a friend who was here this past weekend, I feel as a white woman that a lot of people think I'm privileged. But I think what they don't understand is that I may appear to be privileged, but the kind of discrimination that I face and have faced has been very insidious discrimination, which is not necessarily spoken of. You don't say, well, you're not going to get this job because you're a woman. You might say you're not going to get this job because of some other reasons that are discriminatory, but you don't say it because you're a woman. However, do I think that's the case for women? Absolutely, I think it can be the case for women. So the women's rights movement definitely spoke to me, I think, because I had a strong advocate in my dad and a strong advocate in my husband and an advocate in my brother. I never felt personally, as far as family goes, I never felt personally discriminated against. I have concerns that may have been true in terms of career, but I was really lucky to connect with powerful women in my career. So I had Nadine Lambert as my primary graduate advisor. I had Mary Lee Knapp at Raskob Institute, very powerful woman, and then I had Mary Metz at UC Berkeley Extension, and so I had wonderful women that saw potential in me, hired me, and were wonderful. I also know that there are non-professional incidents, like in stores, interacting with people in restaurants, interacting with service staff. I don't know. There are just many places where I feel that it's obvious that being a woman, I'm not being heard, especially by people who don't know me, because I'm not in their face. I'm just not that kind of a person. And so until they get a chance to know me, I will sometimes wonder if they're not listening to me because I'm just a woman or just another woman. So I do wonder about that, and I don't like it. And when I can call them on it, I will, but in my own way, not in your face. So, yes, the women's rights movement had a big impact on me. And, you know, I mean, to this day, I mean, it's always something that's there. I'm aware of it. It's complicated now by the ageism issue, and that's a very important issue. And so when someone calls me sweetie, who's never called me sweetie before, that's not okay. And I know that that's what you call someone who's either a very little child or elderly. And I'm not elderly, so knock it off.
I don't think you ever will be.
And even when I am, in anybody's mind, I don't want to be called sweetie. My name is Margaret. Thank you. So anyway, more about the Berkeley Times.
Do you remember anything that you read? You said you read everything that you could get your hands on from the feminist movement. Do you remember any of what there were?
Specifically, I can't recall the names. I know that, I can recall the faces.
Because they were people that were there, so you were reading stuff from people that you were encountering?
No, I was reading stuff from people that were, they had pictures with what they'd written. You know, they were on the radio, so you could listen to them. They were on the television, so you could see them. And, you know, sometimes...
Were these people like Steinem?
Yeah, maybe. Gloria Steinem, absolutely. I liked her. I was with her. There were people, and give me some names. There were people who were much more in-your-face activist, and I was glad they were there, but I didn't identify with them. So can you think of some? Like, mostly from New York, if I remember correctly.
From New York. Oh, gosh. Well, I think of people like Shulamit Firestone, but I don't know if they would have been publishing her stuff. I'm also not good at coming up with these names off the top of my head. But I'm also thinking about now this name isn't going to come to me. Well, okay, so I'm curious. Did you ever read The Second Sex? Did you ever read Simone de Beauvoir?
No, if I did, I don't remember.
Yeah,
no,
I mean, it's pretty philosophical, and it's not, I mean, it's a grounding work for that feminist movement, but I don't know how many of them were reading her either. And then I'm also thinking about the one that really kind of broke open the feminist movement in the U.S., and now I'm going to forget what book that was. I'll come back to it if I remember it. There are two memories that I have that connect, that are close to the same time period, that to me speak to the sort of complicated relationship that you had to the feminist movement that was there in Berkeley. On the one hand, I remember having deciding that and I still tell this story constantly because it also talks about my complicated relationship to sexism at the time. I remember being really interested in pole vault and in high school. And I went out for track briefly. Turns out that I do much better running long distances and outlasting everyone than I do running fast. and so track didn't last long, but I got interested in the field side of track and field, wanted to do pole vault. And the track coach, who was the coach for both the women's and the men's team and who was also the football coach, told me that women didn't have the upper body strength to do pole vault.
Right.
And I remember you calling, you know, basically saying, this is discrimination, this is a Title IX case, we should pursue this. I don't know if you said Title IX, but I'm sure that's what was in the back of your head. And I was a teenager and didn't want to make a fuss and didn't want to pursue it. But that was the response from you, was this is not acceptable. This is discrimination, this is sexism, this is not okay. And a few years later, when I discovered feminism you know, as a movement in readings in classes when I was at Stanford, I remember asking you if you thought of yourself as a feminist, because I thought of you as a feminist,
mm-hmm.
and I remember you saying no. And I think today you would claim that word.
Absolutely, yes. I wonder what was going on politically at that time with the women's rights movement.
I wondered if it just had to do with the fact that radical separatist feminism was never your brand of feminism.
No, it's not.
It was mine very briefly, and I needed it for a time, but
mm-hmm.
then it wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder if, and but that was also a prominent part of the feminism in Berkeley. And so I wonder if, either because I was getting into it at the time, or because that was what you associated with it from some of the time at Berkeley, if that's what was in your head when I asked. And if maybe that was why you responded. Because feminism has so many different sides, so many different
mm-hmm.
angles, and I think
yeah.
the feminism that I think we both share a very similar perspective today on it and both claim it, but we're perhaps in very different places with it at the time. I don't
mm-hmm.
know.
Mm-hmm.
But I to me that spoke to the many different faces that feminism had when you were on campus.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
at Berkeley at the time.
No, that's true.
I'm curious about other, there was so much going on. I mean, the free speech movement was not, was fairly closely linked, I think, with the anti-war movement.
That's true.
But I'm also thinking about your work in West Berkeley and the fact that you and Dad led outward bound backpacking trips, and the fact that both the civil rights movement, but also the Black Power movement, were also right there in the East Bay.
Mm-hmm.
What do you remember of those, again, in terms of both how they impacted you as changing your way of seeing things and thinking about things, but also in terms of things that were happening that you weren't comfortable with? Because
mm-hmm.
I've felt that as part of our history as a family, with you and Dad having different reactions in many ways, but both having aspects of all these different movements that Berkeley
mm-hmm.
and Oakland were so much ground zero for, aspects that really impacted your life, changed your perspective, made you think differently, gave you tools and language for things you were experiencing, and also that at some points went in directions that you weren't comfortable with.
Mm-hmm.
So what about civil rights, Black Power, along those lines?
Yeah. Well, you know, that was a part of my sort of commitment at Berkeley from very early on. As a child, we used to travel from Oakland to Richmond, El Cerrito, actually, from my dad's home where we would mow the lawn because of the elderly ladies who were living there and take care of the place, and maybe he collected the rent too, I don't know. And then we would go to my maternal grandmother's in El Cerrito, and we would pass through a section of Oakland and Berkeley, and sometimes through a section of Richmond, where there were a lot of Black people. And I only remember one incident that really shocked me. We were driving along, and there were some Black people walking along the sidewalk, and for some reason, my parents noticed them. And my dad made some comment about, you know, "Will you look at those niggers? What are they doing here?"
Mm.
And I was just shocked. My mom didn't even respond, but I was so shocked. And it was almost like there was, you know, some part of me, I have no idea where it came from, what it was all about, that said, "What? Why are you, that's not nice." I think it was his tone more than the words, because that was not an uncommon word then. But it was the tone that was very derogatory, and it was so contrary to who he was. He's an iron worker. He's an iron worker on the crews in, you know, the East Bay area. So it's probably part of the iron worker culture, would be my explanation now, because it wasn't part of who I thought my dad was. So when you know, we didn't have a lot of different races. Certainly in Danville, we did not. In Madison, it was minimal. Came back to Berkeley, and it was very apparent early on. So this YWCA program that I got involved in, I actually worked with a Black family in West Berkeley, and that's kind of who I am. When I see an injustice, I feel like, yes, I can speak up whenever there's the opportunity, but also I can do a person-to-person something, my little bit of a contribution to another person. And then as a psychologist, there's sort of a fit there because I do a lot of work anyway with individuals. So, you know, that was kind of very, from my first semester at Berkeley, that was something I did for several years. The Black Power Movement, it was way overdue. I'm really glad it was happening. It was also scary because there was a lot of violence around that. And it was a time of recognizing your own identity as a white person, whereas you might not have thought of yourself that way before. And, you know, the women's rights movement, I always knew I was a woman. There was no question. Was I a feminist? That was the challenge. But that was less about the way I appear at that point in the women's rights movement than it was. So the women's rights movement was about who, you know, my body.
Mm-hmm.
The Black Power Movement was also about my body because I was not black, I was white.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, it was a time of huge turmoil in Berkeley. Did it affect me directly? It affected me in the sense that it made my awareness greater of the impact that each of us has on each of us white people have on the lives of black people and other people. And, you know, again, as a psychologist, I'm somewhat aware of that. But when it comes to those kinds of dimensions, and until being made aware early on, before I became a psychologist, I don't know that I would have brought that kind of perspective to my training and to my work.
Mm.
So the Black Power Movement, as I say, it was overdue. I feel like we've made progress with that, like we have with the women's rights movement, but we still have a long ways to go with both. And I don't know what else to say about it.
Yeah. Is there anything else that comes to mind in terms of thinking about the history that you've lived alongside in Berkeley and Oakland, in the Bay Area in general, things that you've seen that people my generation or people, you know, your grandchildren's generation have only read about in history books, but that you saw?
Well, there's nothing that really comes to mind with that.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly I've seen change, and it's been good change, it's been positive change. You know, so when I say there's still work to be done, I mean, I think that's sort of, you know, kind of what everybody says, but it's really true.
Yeah.
So it's one of those things. Yes, we've made a lot of progress. Yes, as a woman, you know, we are now much more legally protected than we used to be. People of different ethnicities and races are much more legally protected than they used to be. That's all to the good. Is the culture changing? I think the culture has changed a bit. I really do think that. And I think the change is a positive change, but it's really, really slow, and so that's kind of frustrating. If you were to, you were raised in a community where you went to school with a lot of white kids, and you also had the opportunity to go to a school in Hawaii that had a lot of children with Asian heritage. If you were to go back to the school where you were, I think you might find more diversity. You would certainly find more students, I suspect, from India, for
mm-hmm.
example. Even your brother had a few more than you did. So, you know, in that regard, I think we're seeing some change. We're seeing some change here in this local area when we moved here. And I think that what was happening at Berkeley got an awful lot of press, and people reacted very strongly one way or the other, like, oh, Berkeley, don't go to Berkeley. You know, Berkeley's a horrible place to go. It's crazy. They have fires. They set their buildings on fire. They, you know, get flown over by helicopters, and everybody gets gassed. But that kind of publicity is really one of the things that provokes change. So, you know, here we are in the foothills of California, near Placerville, which it was when we moved here 20 years ago, very, very conservative community. And over the last 20 years, yes, there's been change. I mean, you and your partner walked in Placerville holding hands, and you were harassed by some men, or young men, maybe. There was a policeman close by. The policeman went after them and took care of it. I'm glad for that. We went to Placerville last night for an event, and there was no harassment going on. There were a lot of people there, and it's changed a lot. The racial mix has changed. I was stunned the other Saturday night, thinking back 20 years ago now, to realize that just during that day on Saturday, I had run across five different people of who appeared to be of African-American heritage. Two of them I knew for sure were. Three of them I didn't have conversations with. And that was just me, you know. So would all of that have happened without this very highly public protest, action, visibility? I doubt it. It wouldn't. So while I don't identify with the violent part of it, which gets the most press, but it's negative press, I do identify with the need to be very public about what we as a culture and a society need to change. Mm. And right now we have other issues. The immigration issue, for example, is a big one facing.
I know you wanted to come forward a little bit in time and talk about your, I don't know if you wanted to talk more about your own experiences with ageism and the ways that it intersects with sexism, but you also wanted to talk about your mom and Alzheimer's. And
no, I forgotten to mention earlier that one of the significant events in my life was when my mom developed Alzheimer's. And we knew that she was having difficulty when she went with us to our cabin in the Sierras, and it had snowed the night before, and it was pretty good snow. And so we'd scraped off the porch with a big orange snow shovel that morning, and then the rest of us went off to do some cross-country skiing, and she stayed in the cabin because she didn't want to go with us, and she was really comfortable there. We came back, I don't know, 4 or 5 hours later from our skiing, and the dog was outside in the snow, and it was really, really cold, and we were concerned about that. He was a big lab, so he wasn't at risk, but it's something that we just wouldn't have done. And when we went in, my mother told us that there had been I think she said there had been a big black dog that had come up on the porch, and she'd tried to chase it away with a broom. And actually, it was the big orange snow shovel, and she'd apparently been, like, threatening the dog with this big orange snow shovel. And that was the first indication we had, along with finding a big bottle of aspirin underneath her pillow after she left, that something was going wrong. And so she went for a diagnosis probably a year and a half later, my brother and I agreed, and she was diagnosed as having Alzheimer's. And fairly quickly, over 6 years, which doesn't sound quick, but fairly quickly went from living independently to living with some support to living with 24/7 care. And it was a very hard time of grieving. Mm. So, like I think many people with Alzheimer's would say, you know, your grieving begins even before the point of the diagnosis, and it continues until after they pass away. So, yeah, that was significant. Mm.
I told you there was a wrap-up question I wanted
yeah.
to ask, but before I get to that, are there other things that we should talk about that we haven't, things that you want to mention, things that feel significant in your own life story or that feel significant in terms of your intersections with other things that have happened in the history of the country or the world or Danville and Berkeley?
This is 2017, and there are political events happening in America right now that I am in such strong disagreement with. And it's a matter of figuring out what my role can be in, besides signing petitions and contributing money and doing those things you can do from afar, how do I become visibly present and make a difference? And so, yeah, I'm struggling with that because I'm very disappointed in what's happening politically right now at the national level. Mm. I'm very proud of California. Speaking of proud, I'm very proud of our children, who are amazing people. They're loving, they're caring, they're very brilliant. They're both outstanding scholars in their own fields. They're wonderful teachers. I'm just so proud of them and happy that they're part of our lives and love them dearly. So, and we have wonderful, each of them has a wonderful spouse. So I'm very pleased with that. So yes, so Melissa's spouse, Nikki, is she's a character. She's a wonderful, loving, absolutely delightful person with incredible history all of her own. And our daughter-in-law Sujata, who is married to our son Wynn, is also an astonishing and very accomplished scholar and teacher, and a wonderful, wonderful person to have as part of our family. Both of those women are. And I guess the other thing I want to mention is how important the LGBT movement is to me and has been for years.
And I left that out in asking about the things that were going on in Berkeley. That's interesting.
Yes.
That's not on my radar as a Berkeley thing, and that's part of how New York has stolen the story from California, which I write about professionally, and yet still impacts me.
Finding ways to make a difference, both personally, being very clear about anything that's said to me that's that's reflective of a bias, feeling very comfortable speaking up, whether with family or friends or just out in general, being involved with our local congregation, which is very actively in support Unitarian Universalist congregation in Sacramento, very actively has for years, and it's the first congregation to actually offer gay marriages, first major congregation, maybe it's fair to say.
I remember that you and Dad, and you youth are also among the first to ordain openly LGBT folks. I remember a few years ago that you and Dad both, as part of something that the church was doing, wrote Valentines to, I think it was Schwarzenegger, who was governor at the time. And I just love the image of Dad writing a Valentine to Arnold Schwarzenegger, but it was on Valentine's Day or around it, and it was all in the interest of activism around same-sex marriage.
It was, yeah. And I participated in several trainings for UUs that were offered regionally and actually California statewide on LGBT issues, helping to inform. Yeah, so that's important, as is a high priority in my life, in addition to riding my horse and enjoying my family, is being involved with court-appointed special advocates, which is a way of giving back to, again, children, because I missed the crayons and the popsicles and the zoos of my career when I was working with children, and so being involved as an advocate through CASA for children who are in the dependency court system is a huge priority for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a wonderful husband, by the way. In case you couldn't tell that from the interview so far, he's fantastic. Yes.
So I told you that my wrap-up question was going to be what you would want to share with people two or more generations from now who are not ever going to get the chance to know you unless a serious revolution happens in medical sciences before then. who will only get to, you know, listen to this interview and hear other people's stories about you and see pictures. And
it's kind of where to begin. I guess, you know, one of the things that I hope you'll know is that you have a wonderful heritage. And so I expect you will be absolutely wonderful too. I would also say, encourage you not to be afraid of change in your life. You know, it's okay that things change. It's good. And to be an active part of that. Don't worry about it. Engage in it. If things aren't going the way you want them to go, be as courageous as some of the people in your family have been to say, no, this is not who I am. I'm not going to keep doing this, or I'm not going to stay in this relationship, or this is not the career I want. I want it to be something different. Be who you are, and don't be afraid of being who you are. If your relationship, on the other hand, has a few little stumbles along the way, engage with your partner or whoever that relationship is in trying to work it through. And if it doesn't work through in a way that satisfies you, then don't let anybody bully you or convince you that you were wrong. Just go ahead and make that change. Be courageous and don't be afraid of change. And know how much you would be loved.
Of course, we ended on a tearjerker note.
Know how much you would be loved if I were there.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, we did it.
When I
3 seconds.
When I click the yes, that's saying we still have a few more minutes that we could do here. That we could use if we wanted to, but when I click the yes, we can't anymore.
I'm good, unless you think of something.
No.